This is rose quartz granite. These blocks are absolutely gigantic.
Fuse them together for a binding agent, which would probably be metal.
Red granite is about 7.5 out of 10 hardness. Bronze, 3.5, 4. So they couldn't have done this with bronze.
This is
the temple entry door, because you can tell because it has a double door. And that's typically a sign that you're coming into a sacred site and into a temple. And so they leave the best work for the high temple work.
I think the Sacred Valley of Peru might be one of the most jaw-dropping areas of the world I've ever been to. This valley down from the high altitude city of Cusco and the megalithic site of Sacsahuaman has some of the most difficult to explain multi-ton, highly precise stonework in the ancient world. Incredibly hard stones like granite and diorite and andesite, constructed upon mountains in gigantic slabs, shaped and placed in the most bizarre and yet architecturally genius styles. We see some of the most phenomenal examples of the stone nub protrusions that we can find across the megalithic world, one of the weirdest commonalities that we see across continents and across cultures that were not supposed to be in any form of contact with one another. And yet we find them everywhere in this ancient and mysterious valley. We trek up the side of mountains into the middle of nowhere to find laser-like cuts into bedrock, local legends of ancient portals and sacred shrines from a time before our own history. We see the unmistakable evidence of destruction on a massive scale and clear signs that the most impressive large-scale megalithic structures in this region go much further back than 600 years ago during the civilizational apex of the Inca, to which mainstream archaeology continues to attribute all of these phenomenal works of stone. These huge and incredibly engineered building projects are far older than we're being told, and in the Sacred Valley of Peru, we see the evidence for that.
Hey everyone, this is a quick video messy hair and background isn't organized. I'm in the middle of editing the video that you're watching right now, and it's become a feature-length production. I just wanted to make you aware that I'm the one that does all the editing. I did all the filming. I went out to Peru on my own. Like, this is a one-man band type of situation. So if you want to support me and you can't do it through Patreon or, you know, actually financially supporting the channel, hit that subscribe button. Please just whack that subscribe button with your finger right now. That's the best way to support me. Drop a comment below in the comment section, like the video, share the video online. But above all else, hit that subscribe button. Make sure you tickle that notification bell as well, otherwise YouTube doesn't send you the videos. Thank you so much and enjoy the rest of the documentary. Previously in my Peru edition of Ancient Technologies, I took you through the historic excavations that are taking place at the megalithic site of Sacsahuaman in Peru, with its incredible multi-ton cyclopean walls of stone that appear as if they've been melted together. I gave you exclusive 4K quality access to the underground digs, presented you with clear evidence that subterranean infrastructure below Sacsahuaman is now being uncovered. Confirming the ancient Andean legends of a vast labyrinth or tunnel network that extends from the city of Cusco to Sacsahuaman and to various other sacred sites across the Andes. So I went down into the ground to show you exactly what the team are finding, these precision carved stones deep below the earth. And these are the beginnings of a plausible entrance into the chambers below, into the potential Chincana, the Grand Labyrinth. I also took you across the wider Cusco region to several of the most anomalous and awe-inspiring ancient sites, providing evidence for precision stonework and capabilities far beyond the Bronze Age toolkit of the Inca. We went inside chambers that are now forbidden for the public to enter, carved into bedrock with incredible skill and bearing the signs of an origin in deep antiquity. And now we travel down the winding roads that lead from the mountain city of Cusco to the great expanse of the Sacred Valley below. Long before the rise of the Inca, before the Huari, before even the earliest known Andean cultures, the Sacred Valley of Peru appears to have been recognized as a powerful and exceptional landscape. Nestled along the Urubamba River, flanked by towering granite and andesite peaks, the valley exhibits a convergence of geological stability and hydrological abundance and astronomical visibility that would have made it uniquely attractive to a potential high civilization. And there are certain areas in the valley where ancient architectural skills are displayed with a level of mastery that just forces us to reconsider who was responsible. Which is why I'm now on my way to the megalithic hillside fortifications of Ollantaytambo. One of the most jaw-dropping ancient sites I've ever been to, especially when you get down onto the ground and explore the various elements of this frankly bizarre complex. Joined by Camille Save, an American-born Sacred Valley local and author of several books on the subject of Peruvian stonework and the various layers of culture that we see on display across the country. It was truly a pleasure to travel through the Sacred Valley with Camille. As a local resident, she was an invaluable exploration partner for this trip and helped me identify some of the stranger signatures in stone that have been left behind by these enigmatic builders. Thank you.
As you enter, you are greeted with these dozens of precision-worked stones lined up as if they're on ceremony, these incredible blocks of granite and andesite that show clear signs of manipulation far beyond what an Inca civilization would have been capable of achieving with such basic tools. They're too soft to work these stones, and yet here they are, recovered during original archaeological studies and put on display as you enter. And we see something here that's very important to highlight. We see what appear to be male and female blocks, meaning that we see blocks with protruding elements and blocks with niches or chambers for these protruding elements to connect into. I saw more evidence of this technique of essentially connecting blocks together like Lego pieces at the Coricancha in Cusco, the city, the sun temple. Very similar style blocks with these male and female elements that were lined up for us to see. So this method of precision joining blocks together, not through mortar, not through a cement or any form of binding agent, but through physically interlocking architecture. Now, you know, this invokes a level of necessity that goes far beyond any sort of aesthetic or ritual requirement. This cuts straight to the need for incredibly strong, force-resistant engineering approaches. On a massive scale, a scale that the Inca civilization, even at its apex, would have been incapable of doing, nor would they have had a reason to want to attempt it, which is evidenced by the Incan architecture and building style that we see across Peru. Across the Sacred Valley, using mortar, using cement, using rough cut stones in simple building designs, structures that are strangely in far better condition today than much of the megalithic work that is far more resistant to force. Now, this is a very important issue. The megalithic work is more resistant to damage, but shows more damage than the simple Inca work, which is far less resistant to damage.
Is this just time that created this break of the rock?
And yet all of the stonework, whether it be the simple rough-cut walls or the precision-fitted multi-ton megaliths, all of it is being attributed to the Inca of 600 years ago. So how can we say that both of these styles come from the same people, from the same time period, when the more advanced structures, which should resist damage, show heavier damage, heavier weathering, heavier erosion, and the less resistant structures, supposedly made during the same time period, are present in far better condition? Now, this is an issue that we see very clearly at Ollantaytambo, and it's not an issue that we can solve by saying that these are examples of progression within Inca stone building phases, precisely due to the fact that there is this damage and erosion discrepancy between the megalithic work and the simple stone and mortar work. The chronology that we're being given doesn't make sense.
Thank you.
Once again, in Ollantaytambo, a lost technique of softening the stone appears to be present in the remaining blocks. There are clear examples in solid granite, diorite and andesite. These are incredibly hard stone materials, where there is no chipping of the stone, as you would expect with simple Bronze Age era chisels and hammer stones. Instead, we see smooth indentations, flowing curves and grooves that look as if they were created when the material itself was somehow malleable.
So you can see where the other rocks were impressed into the rock, right over here. To do something like that with copper tools would have been ridiculously hard and, if not, impossible.
Especially depending on what rock type this is. I don't know if this is granite or this is limestone, but...
Mm-hmm. This isn't limestone. No. This is like diorite.
Right, right.
And then over here you have andesite, which are all volcanic rocks.
Yeah, the majority of this place is andesite, diorite, mm-hmm. granite.
Yeah. And granite up here. So this is probably like a rose granite. This is rose granite right here. So you can see the crystalline nature.
Yep.
Super hard.
And somehow they've smoothed it down and you don't see tool marks. You don't see chipping.
No.
It's just smoothed down.
Right.
And this is the thing, is you would see evidence of brute force, of chipping, of tool marks.
Mm-hmm.
But
exactly.
You don't see any tool marks. So how were they able to smooth down granite mm-hmm. like this?
And here, I mean, you can actually see where another rock was fitting in.
Right.
Here, another one here.
Into these concaves.
Exactly. And another one here.
Yeah.
The surface.
Look at this.
And all that quartz going right through
the
rock as well.
Yeah, it's very striking, actually. That.
Oh, yes. You can see the scoops very clearly.
Right.
Look at this. Let's zoom in. That scooped right out of the granite.
So who had the, you know, the technology to actually soften the stone?
Exactly.
You know, so you could actually bring a trowel or some kind of a spoon and just scoop it out.
Is it possible that either a lost technique of softening stone or a lost technique of literally creating artificial stone was used in these circumstances? And as I said before, the softening technique, if that is what we're seeing, it's not just present in Peru. Another area of the world where we see these strange techniques in abundance is Egypt.
Look at these scoops.
Yes, the scoop marks, yep. So this is something, again, that you find in many megalithic sites, but also this is what you see when I was saying about Aswan Quarry. We've got the unfinished obelisk, and then these scoop marks that are coming out of it like this. And again, this is rose quartz granite. How are you scooping it? How are you scooping this incredibly hard material? No, it's not. You can't even see chisel marks. So these are actually, thanks for pointing this out, bro. This is really good examples of the infamous scoop marks that we do find across the world, but are very concentrated in Egypt, most notably on the Aswan Quarry with the unfinished obelisk. And again, this is incredibly hard stone. The idea that you could scoop out this granite with a copper tool is insane and completely ridiculous.
I don't think that's from where. But like those are pointless.
And there you go, like these big nubs. Look at that.
But they're not big enough, you know what I'm saying? Like wasting.
No, that's the thing. That's what I mean. Like none of these are actually like intuitive to an engineering or like a kind of like function that you would think for the building process.
Right.
it seems like an after effect of the building process.
At the Aswan Quarry, for example, where the huge, unfinished granite obelisk remains, I believe it's over 1,000 tons, this unfinished obelisk, all across this area we see the same scoop marks, these indentations in solid granite that look as if they were scraped away somehow. We see the same effect at the Menkaure Pyramid's red granite outer casing stones. We see it on the 70-ton granite boxes in the Serapeum in Saqqara, the subterranean chambers full of those incredible multi-ton granite boxes. We see the same indentations as if something was dissolving or smoothing away the stone.
A couple of interesting things to point out about the lids. You'll notice these dimples in the lids, and I'll show you several other examples. So the dimples were created to remove cracks from the lids. Any imperfection in the container was removed because when these things were in operation, small cracks would have turned into catastrophic damage. So they had to remove any imperfections, no matter how small, and that's what those dimples are a result of, removing cracks. So the question should be, how did they make them so smooth?
Right.
In my opinion, they were acid etched, where you create a reservoir of like a clay, for example, around the crack. You fill the crack with an acidic solution. It dissolves out the crack. Then you neutralize the solution to stop the reaction. You can wipe the thing out. It effectively removes the crack without the need for additional stonework. And then it leaves you with a smooth dimple. So that way you don't have to hammer or chisel or whatever tool it was that would make the crack worse. You use chemicals. I'm not a guide. I'm a friend. This is my Sadiki. Okay,
he's a friend. He's a friend. He just knows a lot.
The similarity of the style, matched with the same hardness of stone and the absolute inability for copper or Bronze Age tools to impact granite and andesite and diorite in this fashion, these signatures once again become another data point for shared techniques, for shared capabilities, shared knowledge between countries and cultures that, according to our own historical models, were not in contact with one another at these times. Before we head over to the main site of Ollantaytambo with the agricultural platforms, which were built by the Inca alongside the incredible megalithic work that would not have been possible for them to achieve, we're also going to take a quick detour down to a little corner of bedrock where some extremely precise work is on display, and a good juxtaposition between what Camille and many others believe to be the First World, the Second World, and the Third World architecture in Peru, the First World being stonework directly into the bedrock, the Second World being the megalithic work that often surrounds it, and the Third World being the simple Inca structures that surround the other two layers, much like in other places like in Gunung Padang, where we see the layers after layers of civilizations adding onto a site that has been considered sacred in ancient history. The same can be said in Peru, where we see layers of architecture essentially emanating out from a central point, and that central point, more often than not, is the incredibly precise bedrock work that we're about to see.
You know, many people think that the Hanampacha is all created out of limestone, but this is actually andesite. And so here you can see the cavities that are formed within the Hanampacha. And it's actually very smooth. You touch it. Like these walls, it feels almost like vitrification has been applied here. And also you see, you'll notice here, in the corners, how smooth it is.
Oh yeah, it's actually, it's not a 90 degree angle, it's curving into the bottom. They've smoothed
exactly,
it out.
Exactly, yeah. So not exactly a 90 degree angle in there. It's just, and this is very common with all the Hanampacha.
Look at the angles on that. Straight into the bedrock andesite, around 7.5 to 8 on the measurement of hardness. Mm-hmm. And bronze tools sit at about 3.5 to 4, so this is not possible with bronze tools. Cut straight into the cliff. Look at that, guys. And then
also,
down here,
if you look at here, you'll see the knobs.
Oh yeah, so this is it. This always interests me because the knobs, I mean, there are a lot of different explanations for what the knobs might be, but one of the ones the mainstream usually uses is that they were hoisting points for the blocks.
Right.
If they're hoisting points for the blocks, why is it in the bedrock?
Exactly.
Why is it in the bedrock? Why is it jutting out like this? So this is not obviously being used to hoist because you're not hoisting the bedrock. Mm-hmm. What are the knobs for?
Yeah.
I still think it might be an after effect of the building process, a softening of some form, or, you know, like pulling a spoon away from toffee and you get that kind of pull effect of something that's, you know.
So you believe this was one time softened? Well,
perhaps they were, if they were softening it to take away the rock, then maybe this is like an after effect of like bringing it out and you've got like a tuft left over. But I don't know because they're not on every block and they're not on every spot.
Right. And this is actually on the mountain itself. So was it being used to maybe mark some kind of solar, you know, equinox?
Right. So is it actually more of a marking point than anything else? Very interesting.
And
you can
see some of them.
So this one's been broken off.
Broken off right here. And it was also formed very smoothly. It's almost like glass on the top.
Yeah, you can see the shine from over here.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've just got these incredible precision blocks down at the bottom. What are these doing here, I wonder?
Another one that's been broken off right here.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Right, so look at this, guys. So you've got a nub here that's been broken off, a nub here that's still standing, and then you got another one that looks like it's been broken off.
And you can see look at all the calcite that's been forming inside. So were people using this, you know, to touch these things?
Right.
Were they getting a download? You can also see all the veins of calcite growing right over here. And this is all completely smooth.
And then look at this just box cut right into this block here.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely incredible.
Oh, a falcon just flew by.
Oh, wow.
It just went right in.
Yeah,
here.
I just caught it on camera.
Wow.
That's an omen. That's a good omen.
That's a special sign. But you see also how these two megalithic stones, they're actually carved to fit perfectly in with the Hanampacha.
Oh gosh, yeah.
So this is a sign that the megalithic people saw this as somewhat of a special site. And they tended to try to
incorporate this into
their own style.
Into their style. Yeah, so you, because this is something that you focus on actually, is the differences in the fact that you have the megalithic. A lot of people do focus on that, but there is the bedrock work as well, and you think that was from a different people.
I do.
So could you talk a little bit about that? What do you?
Yeah. So basically, when you're looking at Hanampacha, it tends to be in the bedrock itself, and sometimes you'll find it like in Sacsayhuaman or Chinchero. They'll be monoliths, and they almost look like they were made. By man, not necessarily by nature. Though I would say this particular Hanampacha rock is actually created out of the bedrock here at Ollantaytambo. And so this is, I call this Hanampacha. So this is first world. And the megalithic is actually second world. So What's interesting about Hanampacha works is you always usually find this megalithic built right into it, and then later on you'll see Inca work. And if we look over here, we'll start seeing more of the Inca temples. So it, all of the cultures that came after Hanampacha, saw these sites as really special, and they wanted to build their own temples here and to honor the people that were here before.
I find it incredible that the megalithic work was done in a way that essentially attempted to merge it with the bedrock. shaping blocks of granite and andesite and diorite so that they literally connect with the First World architecture. And once again, we see evidence of these male and female blocks with niches in them for other blocks with protrusions to fit inside, connecting stones together like Lego pieces without any mortar, without any cement. This is a completely different style to much of Ollanta Tambo's rough stone walls, mud brick and simple cement using structures, and we'll see even more of this contrast as we continue through this site. So as I said before, when you enter into the site, you'll see all these blocks lined up on the grass, and on the far side of that grass there are these two huge blocks that are just insane. Yeah, these ones are incredible. And this one over here looks bizarre.
Yeah, looks like it's made for hinges.
Yes, like interlocking joints of some form.
Right.
Look at this.
But then you have two scoop
blocks
over here.
Oh gosh, yeah.
It'd be great if they could find the rock.
Yeah, to fit in.
It should be here.
That's so crazy.
Bronze or copper chisels?
Kind of. Yeah? More like in the Europe, right?
This is granite?
Yeah, red granite rock.
Red granite. So red granite is about 7.5 out of 10 hardness. Bronze, 3.5, 4.
Yeah.
So they couldn't have done this with bronze.
The precision, the angles, the reason behind their existence, it's all so baffling. But take a look at these two amazing pieces of ancient stone precision at a level that just can't be achieved with a Bronze Age toolkit. You cannot create this level of precision with bronze and copper on these hardness levels of stone. So we begin to make our way up the stairs, climbing up the main site of Ollanta Tambo, perched upon the hillside, and it's important to note the architecture right now. This is a very simple mortar or cement using wall building technique. Now this is 100% Bronze Age Inca work, and you can actually see where certain blocks are clearly older megalithic blocks which have been repurposed into these walls and the stairs. So this is a case of the Inca building their own structure and using spare megalithic blocks from the original structure that had since collapsed and were feasible for a Bronze Age culture to lift, to use and repurpose. We see this everywhere in the simple Inca stonework, the random incorporation, or perhaps not random, keystones and structural integrity, incorporation of carved, cut, formed blocks that are extremely precise, that contradict all the other simple stones around them. Clearly, this is not just the work done for the wall by the Inca, it's an incorporation of the ancient megalithic structure that is left over. This is something that you just see across all of Peru. It's only when you crest these simple wall structures and stairs that you begin to catch a glimpse of the work above, which even from this distance, as you can see, is a completely different scale of work, a completely different skill set being deployed, and this will only become more apparent as we journey further up towards these walls. These giant slabs.
Also very smooth.
Very smooth.
Yeah.
Just such a difference when you look at these walls and then you look down at what was being used by the earlier civilizations. Clearly a very different style of stonemasonry going on here.
So it's even possible these terraces here and dunes, these were Inca.
Yeah.
So these weren't here when the temple
was? No.
So maybe we just walked up the part that we've accessed right here to the temple. But But all this came later, and people were using it to grow their crops.
Yes, exactly.
And you can tell by the look of the stone that it's a total different quality.
Completely different quality. Yeah. It's actually quite a good point here because you can zoom in on the camera and you can look at these walls here, mm-hmm. and then you can make your way up mm-hmm. and look at this up here. The difference is staggering.
What we're looking at here is some of the outer walls of the Sun Temple. And what you can notice is the outer wall here is much rougher stonework, but still made by the same people. But the higher we go till we reach the Sun Temple, the quality of the rock work, the masonry, is going to be spectacular. You'll see joinery where it's so perfect, you know, you can't get a hair in between the rocks. And so we'll notice that when we go higher up. And also what we're looking at here, many people think that's Inca, but that's actually modern.
Oh, this bit here.
Yeah. And so the archaeologists here are filling up some of the holes
that were left over
from whatever happened that destroyed this part of the wall.
Again, just the difference, like, this is not being lifted and leveraged by the Inca. Yeah. It's simply not possible. This is a huge chunk of granite.
You can also see a little bit of the, like, around a curve here.
Yeah, just here.
Just there, yeah. And on this particular rock, you can see quartz, which is kind of making this triangular.
Oh, yeah.
Going right through the rock. And here is a little lip. So this was probably the outer part of for the wall. And then, oh no, actually I think it was this part.
Just absolutely huge and such hard rock. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, rose quartz granite is no joke.
Perfectly interlocking polygonal blocks that have been shaped to intersect and connect without the use of any cement, any mortar. You can also see where less advanced stonework has been placed on top of it and around it. Again, evidence that the Bronze Age Inca discovered this ancient site and attempted to either preserve or add onto the original structure. The difference in stonework is so starkly contrasting that it would be irrational to claim these styles and skill differences came from the same people at the same time. I struggle with the rationale behind that.
Yeah, once again, here's a knob. But, you know, the center of balance, if you were going to try to lift that up, why would you put it here?
Yeah, know? Exactly.
And the majority of rocks don't even have nubs on this particular wall of the Sun Temple. So...
Yeah, that's what I mean when, you know, the mainstream tries to say, oh, it's for lifting and hoisting. It's like, well, why are they not on every single block?
Right.
If it was for lifting and hoisting, surely they'd be on every single block. And then again, going back to what we just saw, why are they on the bedrock?
Right.
Why are they clearly jutting out of the actual bedrock itself? So, no, it's still a real mystery, the nubs.
As we gain altitude, the architecture gains more sophistication until we're faced with absolutely mind-boggling architecture. Precision-shaped blocks of andesite flow into one another with joinery so precise that it's hard to even comprehend, especially if we are assigning, once again, Bronze Age chisels, copper tools, stone hammers to the task.
where we are at, actually, this is the temple entry door, because you can tell because it has a double door, and that's typically a sign that you're coming into a sacred site and into a temple. And so they leave the best work for the high temple work. And interesting enough, you see these knobs. Yeah. Right now, we don't really know how to interpret them. But perhaps this was some kind of braille system that was telling something important about the builders.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. Maybe they tell a story. Mm-hmm. Because what's the name of the native rope language?
Khipu.
So, you know, the fact that that comes from this kind of culture, the idea of instead of using words and letters, they use like knots.
Right.
These could be knots in rock.
Because you'll also see this at the Sun Gate when you're coming into Cusco.
Yeah.
Coming from the Lake Titicaca area. And right where you're going through the gate is where they have these knobs, and there's a lot of knobs. And it just seems to be at one section of the megalithic, and it's right when you're going through the portal. Or the gateway.
Right. Gosh, this is crazy.
You can't fit a human hair between some of these joints.
How finely that is going into the adjacent rock. So the joinery is just...
absolutely perfect. Second to none.
Perfect.
It's perfect. It couldn't be more... It's perfect. Definition of it. Definition of perfect.
And clearly designed, in my opinion, as an anti-seismic engineering. It's to resist earthquakes. It's to displace kinetic energy.
Absolutely.
Throughout the structure.
Right.
Any sort of like geological kinetic energy, it would transverse through all of the different angles and dissipate throughout the engineering itself. So it clearly was designed with that idea in mind, which makes me wonder why they would do that with that idea in mind.
Uh-huh.
Did they have a foreknowledge, some sort of understanding of cycles on this planet that they had to prepare for a cataclysm of some form?
Yeah.
Feels like they were preparing for something. Maybe they didn't succeed.
We have been here for a long time, and we may have been here with other beings as well. And maybe one's helping us out throughout history. I was just pointing this out, like right here. This, do you see this vitrification right here?
As we see in places like Sacsayhuaman, this level of interconnecting polygonal blocks of solid andesite and diorite and granite would act as a form of kinetic dampener. What I mean by that is they would help in distributing force across the fortification rather than allowing force to concentrate into a local area and cause extreme damage. This type of architecture is designed to be incredibly resistant to damage. It is also in this area that we find a particularly strong concentration of the stone nubs, one of the most mysterious and yet simple looking oddities of the ancient world. We find them everywhere. We see these stone nubs on megalithic work in India, in Turkey, in Egypt, most of the areas where extremely impressive multi-ton precision engineered megalithic structures can be found. Stone nubs, stone protrusions such as these will also be found. Now, the mainstream interpretation of these nubs is that they are leveraging points, places for ropes to be attached for the original moving and placing of the blocks. Now, there are some glaring issues with this theory. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, we actually see stone nubs protruding from what would appear to be the literal bedrock. Okay, these nubs are coming out of the mountain from an area where they were clearly removing stone. So if the nubs are leveraging points, why are they on the natural rock face? The existence of stone nubs on the natural rock face also puts a spanner in the alternative theories, which is that these are signatures of blocks being cast, not cut, but cast from artificial stone. Marcel Fonti is the main proponent behind this theory, that ancients were using an artificial stone slurry that would harden into stone over time, and that the nubs are a signature of where water glass was being drained out of these artificial stones, water glass being one of the elements required for this artificial stone making process, which, to be fair to Marcel, he is actually demonstrating at his home lab in Budapest, and I'm going to be flying out there myself to see his work firsthand and decide if it matches up with what we see in the ancient world. However, the existence of stone nubs on the natural rock face does make this theory problematic for explaining all of the examples of stone nubs, unless we're making an argument that the mountain itself, of which this bedrock is a part of, is in fact artificial, which is a bit of a stretch for me. Up high on the mountain fortifications of Ollantay Tambo, we see stone nubs all over the place, not on every block, but distributed across the various facades of this complex. This is another reason why the mainstream leveraging point theory doesn't really hold weight, pun intended. Because they're not present on every block, and when they are present, they're rarely, if ever, in a logical position or of the correct size for lifting. They're not placed on all four corners or directly central. There doesn't actually seem to be a form of symmetry to it at all, at least not for an engineering or construction purpose. When you go to places like this, for example, the Coricancha, the Sun Temple in Cusco, this is supposed to be one of the most sacred and important sites, a royal site, and yet we come across totally smoothed down, beautiful ashlar block walls, and then suddenly, bam, there's a whole wall of these stone nubs concentrated in one particular area. So I don't think that they're leveraging points. You'd think that they would sand them down, like somehow smooth them down for a royal construction, and yet you have completely smooth walls and then a bunch of nubs on a very specific area. So I actually hold space for them being, of course, a signature of softening the stone, but it's far from conclusive, and I do actually think that it could be, potentially, a coded language, because we have to remember that the only so-called written records from the Inca, their history, their recollection of events in the past, none of it was actually written. They had an incredibly strange form of symbolic language called quipu, which was literally different lengths of string in various colors with little knots tied into each string at different points, and this actually corresponded to data, to language. This is how they kept records of events, and there would be designated quipu readers in the Inca cultures. Now, this format was almost completely erased from Peruvian history due to the Spanish conquistadors who burnt the quipu. Fragments remained, and some Inca shamans were taken into the Spanish courts to read quipu, but for the most part, the entire recorded history of the Inca Empire was destroyed, burnt by the Spanish, completely erased from modern memory. So a lot of the history that we get from ancient Peru is from oral tradition, from the Andean shamans, oral history, and also the retelling of that history through the chronicling of Spanish conquistadors, who, let's be honest, would have applied their own bias to observing this history. So we have a very, very incomplete history of Peru. Perhaps these stone nubs are an even older form of quipu, where the knots are tied into stone, so to speak. Perhaps we're actually looking at the same type of coded language, but formed through stone rather than through string. It's just a thought. I don't know either way, and neither does the mainstream, and that's the important bit. It's all still a mystery. Stunning levels of precision joinery in stone that would defy all attempts from the Bronze Age to do this. This is where reality smacks you in the face a little bit. There is just no way these walls were created by a Bronze Age culture. Nothing about them is a demonstration of Bronze Age capabilities. Their existence is a direct contradiction to what could have been achieved at that time period with the extremely simple tools at their disposal. And this is not to denigrate the Inca, who managed to raise up an incredible civilization in a very short time span. The apex reign of the Inca lasted less than 100 years before the Spanish came in. They were present and growing before then, of course, but the height of Inca civilization lasted for about 90 years. These are not periods of time that can be easily matched up with the incredible megalithic work all across Peru. This is why we have to question the chronology. They were simply not around for long enough to be doing the type of work, especially because we can juxtapose this type of work with the work we know they were doing, the work surrounding Ollantay Tambo and other sites, the simple stone, simple mortar using, easy to fabricate, not megalithic, not precision fitted, not multi-ton building projects. The differences are absolutely staggering when you compare the two. And a lot of the time it's very easy to compare the two because you've got megalithic right next to the simple stone structures. One of the most noticeable geometries incorporated into the design of these structures is the reverse trapezoid alcoves and windows. Here at Ollantay Tambo, we see incredible examples of these shapes carved directly into the andesite and diorite stone, multiple times harder than the Bronze Age tools that we applied to their creation. And what's interesting is that you also see that these reverse trapezoid shapes were incorporated by the Inca into their own much simpler structures, which was a clear case of copying, of being inspired to attempt to replicate what they saw, and they did replicate them, albeit in a much simpler form with less impressive structural integrity and using softer stones. Nevertheless, the Inca were clearly trying to recreate the work they discovered at Ollantay Tambo. Many of the blocks here also have a shine to their surface. Now, this is indicative of vitrification, which is an effect caused by when stone is heated at an extremely high temperature, at which point they partially melt, and then upon cooling, form a glassy, fused, or vitreous rock. So why are so many of the blocks in Ollantay Tambo demonstrating this signature of vitrification? Did a high heat event impact this site? Because the temperature required for this far exceeds the explosive and heat potential of Spanish conquistadors with gunpowder. Okay, this requires heat on a far superior scale of intensity. This is something more akin to a major solar flare. And once again, inviting us to reconsider a far more ancient origin point for these incredible structures, potentially outlasting cataclysmic impacts on this planet over 12,000 years ago. As we approach the peak of Ollantay Tambo, we're greeted by absolutely colossal slabs of rose quartz granite that we're supposed to believe were essentially rolled down the hillside towards the construction site. By the way, this area famously has very few trees, so log rolling is basically out of the question. How the mainstream models can claim these huge blocks of granite were quarried and then rolled or pushed down the hillside towards the building site? It's ridiculous.
Have one of the most impressive Hanampacha thrones than they typically call these Inca thrones, probably pre-Inca. And you can see it's carved right out of the bedrock and beautifully smooth shaping and seats that are formed into the Hanampacha. So it's funny, most people just walk through and never notice this, but it's quite a beautiful, beautiful rock to look at.
Huh. All its colors. Not a bad place for a seat.
Yeah, what a view, right? Super, super smooth, the seats. Just like the rock we saw down below. I think I'll focus on because of that. The cut going all the way through, and you can really see it on the side. So we're not sure what kind of technology actually like cut right through it. I mean, whether it was a high power saw or perhaps it, when it was soft, they could easily just
slice it off.
Slice it off, yeah.
Wow, it goes all the way to here.
Yeah.
How did Bronze Age era people pull something like this off, and why does this megalithic work seem to be spread around the hillside with huge breakage points, scattered like Jenga pieces, while the simple, rough-cut walls remain sturdy, stable and still standing? Basically, the weakest architecture outlived the strongest architecture. Now, if we're going to believe the Inca were responsible for all of this work, how do we explain the fact that inferior architecture showcases less damage than superior architecture? That right there is just a massive problem for the currently established chronology for these places.
Look at this. And this is rose quartz granite by the look of it.
Yeah.
The size of these is just absolutely incomprehensible when you consider that they were having to lift them all the way up here. This is rose quartz granite. These blocks are absolutely gigantic, and they precision cut them and then lifted them all the way up and constructed this. Now look at what we are seeing in front of us now.
One of the most striking features at Ollantaytambo is this enormous wall of rose granite, complete with some strange details, including stone nubs of varying sizes protruding from the blocks, easily up to 100 tons or more, and yet it feels incomplete. It looks as if there was once much more of this, which would explain why massive blocks of granite are scattered across this entire area. Is it possible that these extremely large blocks just happen to be able to resist whatever force caused the rest of the structure to be essentially blown apart? Sliding down the hillside around it, embedded into the earth. I just find this particular area to be fascinating because of the size and the precision on display, and it even looks as if some of the areas have been plastered on, a very strange feature that we do see in other sites of Peru. It's like a scoop mark, but it's almost like someone placed one of those paint scraping tools over the stone and pushed down. These square indentations into solid granite are very odd, and once again, we have to highlight the absolute lack of tool marks. Where are the chisel marks? Where are the overcuts? There is essentially zero evidence of the tool that's being used to fashion the blocks.
And then look at these gigantic nubs. Oh my gosh.
There is a belief that these were once, I don't know, it is said that this was a puma, but it's kind of hard to see
it's
that.
It's hard to see that, yeah.
But look at even how the wedges in between, look how perfectly they are fitted into the rock here.
This is truly incredible.
And it is believed that these inner wedges are used to stabilize it even more.
Right.
So if there is an earthquake, they end up buffering and supporting the rock.
Just strange formations, evidence of novel material manipulation techniques, like this big chunk of granite that looks almost identical to what we see in Aswan Quarry in Egypt. Look at the scoops of stone that have been taken away from the main body of this rock in a fashion that makes it look as if it were once soft and scooped away like ice cream. It's just very strange, this particular block and the grid-like scoop marks at Aswan Quarry are strikingly similar and leave us with nothing more than questions about how this was done in such incredibly hard stone at a time when the tools were so primitive and softer than the material they're being used against. Around the back of these giant red granite blocks, we see evidence for Inca restoration, filling in the gaps that were made long ago with their more simplistic stone stacking techniques. The idea that these huge granite blocks were placed here and then filled in with simple stones by the same people seems irrational when you look at the surviving elements of the megalithic work that seems to excel above all else in precision and size. Precision joining of multi-ton blocks. There is nothing precise about filling in gaps in with loose rocks. So I would argue that this is further evidence for Inca discovery and attempts to restore and maintain these sites. And it's again evidence that there was some form of major disruption, because where are the rest of the red granite blocks? They've clearly been moved apart, and you see these remains coming down the hillside. So many of them may have been blown away, leaving these gaps, which were then filled in by later culture.
I haven't quite figured out what's going on here. How did these rocks get separated?
Huh.
You know, and this is Inca fill,
yeah,
and more modern fill. But what caused them to separate like this?
Yeah, because obviously these would have been fused together quite tightly, like the others around the corner.
Right.
As you can see, actually, just here with this one, that's how they would have been joining.
Some very strong lateral force.
Another extremely interesting element of some of these blocks is the inclusion of what appear to be melding points between them, where perhaps a molten metal of some form was poured in. Now, this is not unique to Peru. It's actually found across the ancient world, even at sites believed by the mainstream to be prehistoric, suggesting a method of joining blocks together with an anchor of some form between each one. Now, this is not something we see on every block. In fact, it's not that common at all to see this. Even though we do find these examples across the world, it doesn't seem to be a standard practice on the stone building here. So it makes me wonder why these blocks. What is it about these blocks in particular that required what appears to be a form of anchor point?
Is that it had it had its paired rock over here.
Yeah,
and it had
fused them together through a binding agent, yeah, which would probably be metal.
Probably. But what kind of metal? Some people say copper, but would that have been strong enough?
Maybe bronze?
No, I believe there was somebody he actually took a picture here, and it looked like drill holes, like from some machine. Let's see if it's over here. Oh, yeah, here it is. Yeah, so right over here. It's kind of hard to see, though.
Oh yeah, no, you can see some striations. Hang on, let's zoom in on that. Yeah, you can just about make out some striation marks.
Right. Yeah, he had actually a really good video where you can see it quite clearly.
And based on its hollowed out nature, I imagine it was filled with something and a metal would make sense. It would also make sense that the metal was looted out of the blocks long before modern times, which would explain their absence. Either way, it's a very interesting and often overlooked technique that is worth highlighting. Maybe you have a different idea for why they have been adding these into the blocks. One thing I'll say is just an additional thought. The rose quartz granite being used is piezoelectric. It naturally produces electricity when placed under mechanical stress. So if this effect was in any way being exploited by the original builders, then the anchor point, the connecting node between the two piezoelectric blocks, may have been copper or gold. It might not have served as a structural reinforcement element, but as an electrical conduction feature that could interact with the piezoelectric effects of the granite. So that's just a thought to consider in the ether. I just noticed while looking back on the footage as well that this very large block of red granite also has niches carved into the ends of it, which could have been anchor points between blocks. So just thought I'd bring that up since I only just noticed it while reviewing the footage.
Oh, it's a shame you can't go over there.
I mean, you probably could if there's no security.
I think that guy's a guide. He might say something, but...
It's really interesting. I just noticed this. I hadn't noticed that before, but that seems to be like an Audi knob that could fit into...
one of the like niches.
Yeah. And look at the rose quartz, how whatever it was pushed it out and it landed on these stone tiles. But you can really see the precision work right over here and right on these edges. This is just time that created this break of the rock.
Yeah.
It's like tiling for floors.
Yeah.
And they're very precisely cut. And so this might have been one of the foundations of the site.
Right.
And you can see now, after this destruction that hit and blew these stones away, you know, the later culture of Inca built right on top. So this might have been just pure platform.
Right.
Still have vestiges of the Hanampacha over here in the megalithic. So.
Oh, yeah.
It's like.
Yeah, so it's kind of like the Hanampacha, then the megalithic is incorporated into that as a sign of respect, and then the Inca's building on top of the megalithic as a sign of respect, and maybe also the Hanampacha. And it's layers and layers of history and architecture that is unfortunately still getting bundled all together into the same chronology, and I just don't think that's sensible at all. Doesn't make any sense. I mean, look at these blocks, and you cannot comprehend a Bronze Age civilization leveraging these. And
yeah, it is claimed like the Inca, you know, basically used ropes, and but these had to come from the quarry over here.
Right.
And so they, it is believed they rolled them down like the mountain, but the fact that we don't see much breakage, the breakage we do see probably came from the catastrophe that jumbled these rocks and threw them everywhere.
As we near the top of Olente Tambo, the megalithic work is replaced by almost entirely rough-cut mortar-using walls. So this is a very clearly Inca construction at the crest of the megalithic complex. There are elements of what the locals call Hanampacha, which is the first world architecture, which almost exclusively is cut into the bedrock directly, and often demonstrates quite a sophisticated hydrological knowledge for channeling water through the stone, something that we'll see more evidence for when we get back down to the bottom of this site. But this is a very important area to showcase the stark differences. It's a lovely series of structures, but let's be honest, these structures don't hold a candle to the level of sophistication and advanced engineering represented by the megalithic work just below it. And yet once again, we see these simpler structures have managed to survive the test of time far better than the megalithic work, which makes no sense. It doesn't make sense if it was a geological event, and it doesn't make sense if it was Spanish conquistadors, because how could the Spanish conquistadors destroy huge multi-ton megaliths with gunpowder, which is not strong enough, they didn't even have dynamite, but they didn't bother blowing up the really easy to destroy buildings. I mean, if I took a sledgehammer to these structures, I could bring them down. So isn't it weird how they're standing almost completely perfect? Little bit of degradation, some bits falling down, but these walls, based on what you see with the megalithic structures, these walls should be turned to dust, but they're completely freestanding and fine. That's a massive problem. And it's brilliant that in Olente Tambo, you actually have a physical juxtaposition, a real in-your-face contrast of incredibly, incredibly sophisticated and incredibly simple, very basic, hugely damaged, mainly still standing, and we're being told that these two overlap on the same chronology. Nana, sorry, doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense. So as we go back down onto the ground level, there is still no shortage of strangeness to be found, like these huge slabs of diorite that have scoop marks in perfect vertical lines going down the body. No chisel marks, no chipped areas, just smooth lines going down. Once again, as if someone had scraped a tool across its surface and somehow scooped away some of the diorite. I also don't know if this is bedrock or something else. The grooves go down beyond the earth line, so this could very well continue on, but I mean, it hasn't been excavated, and I saw absolutely no one coming over here to look at it. One of the weirdest examples of manipulating and removing incredibly hard stone without evidence of Bronze Age tools, and it's just sitting here being politely ignored by 99.9% of the tourists. And according to Camille, she's never seen a local guide bringing people up here to take a look at it.
See, it just took him right past this one. It took him right past.
And it's got various grooves and channels in the top of the stone as well. It's not just these scoop marks, but on top of it, there's all sorts of strange channels and grooves and cuts, but nothing here would signify stone quarrying. It just looks like someone was messing around with the stone. How and for what reason, we don't know. I'm not really trying to provide you with answers. I'm trying to highlight the fact that we don't have good answers. We still have a ton of questions. All right, so we look at these places, we have theories, we have ideas, we have opposition to the mainstream model, but all of this is just a question mark. Nobody's got a definitive reason for how they were scooping the stone or softening the stone, and no one's got a definitive reason for the stone nubs. Nobody's got a reason for the requirement of this incredible megalithic force-resistant interlocking architecture. It's not about really gaining answers right now, more so about trying to find the higher fidelity questions. What are the better questions that we need to be asking? Clearly this area was special. The bedrock itself has been dressed and smoothed down and worked and formed into some very strange patterns all the way around this particular area, but why the nubs? I feel like the nubs protruding from bedrock is a big issue. It's a big issue for both the mainstream and also the alternative explanations. Clearly these are not lifting points, like the mainstream says. But the equally placed challenge on the idea that all of the blocks were cast from liquid artificial stone, and that the nubs are an after effect or component of that process, because why are they on the bedrock if they're an element of a casting process where you're using a mold? Another issue I have with the casting theory, especially in Peru, is the fact that essentially each polygonal block used in ancient megalithic stone building in Peru is a different shape. They all fit together in incredible ways, but none of them are identical, so you would need a mold for each block shape variation. That is an incomprehensible amount of molds. And also, where are they all now? Where are the cast molds? Where are the like leftover shells of the molds? Like, I don't see a whole lot of evidence for that, personally. But there are areas that raise that question. It's not to be dismissed entirely. I just don't think it explains all of the various architectural anomalies in Peru and Egypt and India and Turkey and Greece. I don't think casting and molding explains everything. I think it's a little bit unintelligent to kind of just say, oh yeah, it's cast. Okay? Like, not everything is cast. I think the bedrock stone nubs do challenge this idea, but I absolutely hold space for some element of stone softening or use of a novel stone mixture, like the whole theory behind molding these artificial granites and artificial diorites into other structures as almost like a veneer, like a plaster on, like a plasterboard. It's possible. Around the corner, we see various pens or foundations from Inca times, again with rough cut stone, mud and mortar binding each one together. But these Inca work have been built around some very strange pockets of advanced bedrock and megalithic work. Another example of the Inca venerating and respecting the previous work and building their own structures around it. Because once again, this is a diorite, it's incredibly hard. And what we see is, frankly, astonishing huge chambers of excavated bedrock. Polished to a fine shine, perhaps even displaying signatures of vitrification, but removed from the bedrock with such incredible precision. Again, no tool marks, no chisel marks. It stands out amongst all of the simple stone walls around it. You know, it's something of a completely different order of magnitude and skill. And continuously, we are just left wondering, why? Why do this? This would be such a huge physical undertaking. And the tools we believe were being used couldn't possibly have been used. And so this is either tremendously difficult but extremely important for whoever was doing it, or it was tremendously easy. And honestly, I'm starting to believe that whoever was making these marks in the bedrock didn't consider it to be that much of a challenge. The amount of examples we find across Peru of this level of stonework would suggest that this was something being done quite regularly, and yet the Bronze Age tools wouldn't allow for this to be done regularly, so we must invoke different tools. And also, the Bronze Age Inca culture didn't exist for long enough to be putting so much man hours into chiseling andesite and granite and diorite. You know, people make the argument in Egypt for that. Oh, well, it just a lot of slaves and a lot of time and a lot of effort. Even that's really dumb. It is really dumb. But you can try and invoke it because they've got thousands of years worth of culture. The Inca don't have thousands of years worth of culture. So they don't have the expanses of time required to dedicate themselves to cutting out huge niches of andesite out of cliff sides. And why do it? Why do it? They're cut in ways that aren't even blocks, because you don't see blocks that are made in this shape. So they remove diorite. Why? Like, I don't see the diorite they removed being incorporated into the structures, because the shape that they've removed it in isn't a block. It's like usually a trapezoid, this reverse trapezoid shape. And it's just like, what's the purpose of it? Then is the niche the purpose? Not the removing of the stone, but the making of this alcove? And if so, why? And again, the amount of effort required to do that. Like, come on. Come on, people. It doesn't match. It does not match. Here is a great example of the first world Hunanpacha work in the bedrock, and a copycat version of it done by the second world megalithic builders, created in a way so that it could nearly be inserted right next to the bedrock carving, replicating its style. Why? What's the significance of this? I find these strange little niches fascinating because it would require so much more effort than it looks. This is a major undertaking. And although the perspective might be slightly off, I'm quite far away from that block. That's a large block of andesite that they've placed in there. And for what purpose? To put a pretty picture on the mountain? It just feels so much deeper than that. It feels so much deeper than that. It feels like a signpost, a signature, something important that is now completely being overlooked and surrounding it all across the cliffs. I mean, all across this entire area. We see these incredible stepped cuts into the bedrock. In fact, the more you look at this entire area, the more you see. From precision cuts and dressed walls to stone nubs in the bedrock and these reverse trapezoid niches. The whole cliffside is a mosaic of stone masonry, and yet not in ways that would appear typical for stone quarrying. Something else was going on here, and I don't think we've managed to figure it out yet. We see more examples of these Lego-like blocks, male and female connective elements that would fit together without binding agents. Just such an incredibly precise and sophisticated method of architectural engineering that has to be appreciated. I mean, whoever was truly creating these blocks had a knowledge far beyond what should have been available in antiquity. I don't think I have seen anywhere in Peru where the distinctive layers of different architecture are so clearly defined, because in Ollantaytambo, they are literally right next to each other. So again, we have all of this incredible bedrock work that is believed to have been of the first world, long before the Inca, long before our own history began. And then you have the second world megalithic ashlar, more precise block building. The Nalpamachu, the first people in Andean lore, who were believed to have existed in a previous age and possessed greater knowledge and strength, but were destroyed by catastrophe. The same story we hear across the ancient world of global catastrophe and the existence of supernatural civilizer godlike beings that the ancients attribute as the megalithic stone builders and the bringers of knowledge into a post-cataclysmic world. It's really only the modern historical institutions approving interpretations that deem all of this fanciful and folklorish and unnecessary to explore in more detail. But when you do explore, you begin to see how these ancient mythologies may have had a more clearly defined place in real history than our current academic and historical institutions and models and frameworks will allow for. Comparing the work you see on this stone wall to the work we see here is simply not possible. They are night and day. It's the wall equivalent of a horse and cart being compared to a Ferrari. And here you can see where a piece of megalithic stone has been repurposed by the Inca for their own simpler wall constructions. And we see this time and time again, the repurposing of the megalithic work, but within reasonable and feasible levels. You don't see them lifting 50 to 100 ton blocks. They use blocks that a few strong men could have picked up. Again, things that were actually feasible for a Bronze Age civilization. Now, this next bit's very strange. It's not something that we see again, actually, not in Ollantaytambo or in any other site I visited. There are many of these alcoves in the bedrock. I've showed you several of them. Perhaps this is something that's present on all of them, but this is the only one that was easy enough to get up to. Now, admittedly, you're not really supposed to go up here and do this, but I did know about these marks already, and I just knew that I had to get high-quality 4K documenting of these particular signatures in the stone. I don't know what we're looking at here in terms of purpose, but these are laser-like straight lines etched into a pattern through solid diorite rock. That is incredible. I mean, you can't achieve these cuts with a copper or bronze chisel. Yet here they are, deep and precise grooves crisscrossing each other in this amazing symmetrical pattern. I don't know why this was done or what was used to do it. It's just a fascinating little hidden gem in Ollantaytambo that has never been recorded in this level of quality before. Here is another example of the first world bedrock architecture that incorporates hydrology into the design. And weirdly enough, with this particular channel, you can disrupt the flow of the water simply by running your finger across the surface. It's really quite bizarre, and I'm not sure what would cause this. So if anyone has ideas around why the water flow would be significantly disrupted by a finger quickly running across it, please drop a comment below. I'm curious to see what people think about that. But this is another example of a hydrological knowledge that is extremely interesting and shares correlations with what we see in the ancient Egyptian world in terms of hydrological engineering. Think of places such as the Osirian in Abydos, megalithic in his style, without any of the hallmarks of dynastic Egypt, no hieroglyphs on its megalithic core, and the Osirian is constantly flooded due to a series of hidden shafts that connect directly into the water table, constantly pumping water through the structure. And we see plugs at the base of the pyramids internally, something that Jeffrey Drum from the Land of Kem strongly believes to be drainage for when water was flowing through the pyramid systems.
So you said you went in Menkaure Ra?
We didn't go inside it, we went around the exterior and filmed the Cyclopean.
So the patched hole. So there is a hole like this at the bottom of the northern inlet shaft of the Red Pyramid.
Right.
The Pyramid of Wanis, the Pyramid of Teti, the Pyramid of Menkaure Ra, all have holes like this at the bottom of the descending shaft. This is where water was introduced into the structure. It's the inlet shaft.
Right.
Yeah. Water facilitated the whole process inside of the structure, both as a physics-based mechanism of operation for manipulating temperature and pressure, but also as a reactant.
And so in Peru, we also see hydrological engineering, channeling water through carved bedrock, and in some cases, such as this, producing apparently anomalous effects in water flow when interacted with.
Yeah, go on.
Let's slow it down.
Oh, yeah.
And start it back up. Slow it down. Slow it back.
What explains that?
So the rock has a positive electric property. And it just, it can slow that water down or sometimes stop it. I've actually stopped it with my finger.
Wow.
And up above, there's, the water comes in and it kind of flows in a whirlpool. So it kind of structures the water.
Kind of in a vortices.
And here we just have a huge block of granite in the town of Ollantaytambo that was so huge, they just built the town around it. Rather than trying to move it, again, just demonstrating how in even modern times they would struggle to lift these multi-ton blocks, and it's easier to just leave it where it is and build what we need to build around it. Another case against the Bronze Age Inca lifting these with apparent ease. There's just no good evidence for how they were able to do that. Exploring the town of Ollantaytambo itself, you'll see example after example of this incredible combination of both Inca stonework and even older megalithic structures that have been incorporated into the modern township, just like in Cusco. It's an amazing aesthetic when you walk around these towns surrounded by huge megalithic cyclopean walls and gates. As we're walking around, we actually came across a traditionally dressed elder lady who, it turns out, was a guinea pig farmer. I'm sorry to all of you guinea pig lovers, but they are considered a national delicacy in Peru called cuyi. It was cute for a moment before you realize their ultimate fate.
Hey, guys. Sorry you're going to get eaten. Oh, babies. He's a big one. Mucho. Mucho. Down there, like wobbling. It is an interesting noise. Oh, look at them.
Oh.
For lunch.
Yeah.
This is their lunch.
Gomez, Alfa Alfa.
Yeah.
Abina.
Wow.
Pastito come.
Now, the last stretch of our journey today is a very special place, not so easy to get to. It does require a little bit of a drive and a bit of a hike, but very worth it if you do get the opportunity to get out into the Sacred Valley. I cannot recommend this enough. I knew I had to be the first to get the high quality video of this site. We stop in this incredible area of the Sacred Valley where you just have these huge cliff faces towering above you. I also love this old school train just belching smoke as it trundled down the tracks. I thought to myself, what a place to be a train driver, you know, what a landscape to travel through as a job. And then I realized that's exactly what I'm doing for a job, and I felt really happy about the overall situation. Thousands of stairs must be traversed, cutting their way down through this rugged cliffside, and the oxygen levels are a little more manageable in the Sacred Valley in comparison to Cusco at higher elevation, but the hike still managed to steal my breath on several occasions before we finally got to our destination of Nahuapa Iglesia.
Hola.
This sacred alcove is home to two absolutely mind-blowing works of stone. The altar, carved directly into the bedrock, indicative of the First World culture that Andean myth speaks of, and very similar in style to the water channel I showed you earlier. Incredibly precise stonework, impressive geometry, and with an incredible interlocking effect as it leads into the bedrock below. This is once again a signature we find in Egypt, most prominently on the Giza Plateau, where the limestone bedrock was deliberately carved into niches that would then fit perfectly with equally shaped limestone blocks to create the foundation level of the plateau, literally anchoring the plateau foundation and pyramids into the bedrock through a very similar Lego block style that we see in Peru.
So these pieces, where you see indentations like this, again, I use the comparison to a Lego, where it has male and female pieces that would have mated to lock the stones in place. So anytime you see these weird indentations like this, this is where paving stones were sitting on top of this, because this is bedrock here. And it originally would have had paving stones like this that covered the bedrock and mated with the bedrock in locking pieces. So they not only carved the bedrock to have indentations, but then the paving stones would have had other indentations that locked everything in place. You see that throughout the construction process.
Nahuapa Iglesia has a very similar effect as it leads down into the uncarved bedrock below. But this is not the only element of Nahuapa Iglesia, a place where the locals will come for pilgrimage and leave flowers and coca leaves as a sign of respect, as a spiritual site. Now, directly behind this strange, dark stone altar, you find one of the most incredible examples of precision stone excavation in the ancient world I have ever seen. Reminiscent of what we see in the Barber Caves in India, this false doorway, I suppose you could call it, has been created with staggering precision. If we are once again invoking Bronze Age tools for the job, we see no tool marks whatsoever, zero. You tell me if you see a chisel mark on that wall. This is not just an artistic statement. There are legends attached to this false door. And the legends would say that it is certainly a gateway, certainly a doorway, but it is by no means false. Local shamanic contacts with historical lineage in the Sacred Valley area claim this is a harmonically responsive gateway, that there is essentially a secret song, a series of frequencies that when performed in the correct manner will unlock the gateway and allow someone to pass through to the other side, to the world of the gods, to the realm of the gods. Or so the legends go, at least, including one of an Incan priest who, during the Spanish conquest of Peru, removed the sacred golden disc, the sun disc, from the Curicancha, from the sun temple in Cusco, and he brought it here, and he passed through the gateway. Whether these legends hold true or not, the gateway is incredible nonetheless, and it adds further confusion to who was truly responsible for this work and why. But I will admit that I love the idea that this is an ancient stone portal or gateway. We all want a bit of that in the world, don't we?